Hi, this is Josh Barrow. On Thursday, October 20th, KCRW is coming out of our basement studios for a civilized, yet provocative, Left, Right, and Center Live. Join us at the beautiful Ace Hotel Theater in downtown Los Angeles for a night of amusing and insightful commentary on this unique election season. I'll be joined by Kelly Goff, Gene Sperling, and Mona Charon as we dissect Trump versus Clinton, Democrat versus Republican, and fact versus fiction. Buy your tickets today at kcrw.com/LRCLive.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Syria, where civilians are facing war without end. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. The subject didn't come up in this week's first encounter between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, but the nation of Syria is turning to rubble. The U.S., Britain, France, and U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon have accused the Assad regime and its Russian ally of committing war crimes. Today, we'll hear the voices of boys in Aleppo playing in water-filled craters created by barrel bombs that have killed their friends and their families. We'll talk with the doctor's wife who filmed that scene and a peace activist who's met with Bashar al-Assad, along with other observers. On our talking point later, Elon Musk and the highway to Mars. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app. Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Mormon Alney, back with To the Point. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has accused Russia and the Syrian government of war crimes in the siege of Aleppo. With each side blaming the other, it's a crisis likely to face the next president of the United States. We'll hear from a bombed-out neighborhood in Aleppo. Today's talking point, the futurist entrepreneur Elon Musk says humanity has only one alternative to inevitable extinction here on Earth. It's the colonization of outer space and other planets. He says we can get to Mars in less than 10 years. First, this news update. Shimon Peres died today at the age of 93, the last of Israel's original founders. He was both a soldier and a peacemaker. Joel Greenberg is a veteran freelance journalist based in Jerusalem. Joel, good to have you back on our program.
Good to be here.
93 years old, that's a long time for an elder statesman. And he was, however, a man much celebrated around the world, but somewhat controversial in Israel itself.
Yes, well, as a politician, over the decades, he was often seen here as a kind of an underhanded backroom dealer. He had a famous feud with Yitzhak Rabin, who was later went on to be prime minister. But later, he did become very popular, as you said, as an elder statesman, as the state president, which is a ceremonial position. But his dream of peace and his vision of peace and what he called a new Middle East is still seen in Israel by most Israelis as a very distant dream and maybe a pie-in-the-sky idea that never really materialized.
As president, you say that was a ceremonial job, but he was twice prime minister. What were his regimes like?
Well, in one, he never really outright won an election on his own, but he did serve in a coalition government with the Likud party. He also succeeded Yitzhak Rabin after Rabin was assassinated, but then lost the election afterwards to Netanyahu. So the short time that he did follow up Rabin, he did proceed with the Oslo Accords, but his short term there was marred by a war in Lebanon and continued suicide bombings in Israel, which led to his defeat by Netanyahu, and basically derailed the course that Rabin set, with Peres guiding him along the path of the Oslo Accords.
He did win the Nobel Peace Prize in 1994 for what happened in Oslo.
Yes, he did. In fact, the Oslo Agreement was really done under his leadership from the Israeli side, team working under him, and then he persuaded Rabin to come around with that, and he was given credit for that, and he continued to preach that vision even after the Accords unraveled in the ensuing violence in the following years. And Israelis kind of lost faith in the peace process. Netanyahu was elected repeatedly as prime minister, but Peres continued with his vision of peace and always thought that Israel could not survive for long in a constant state of warfare. But the realities of Israeli politics were that a right-wing conservative government has been elected and re-elected, and its policies have been very different.
His funeral is likely to draw the leaders of the Western world, the presidents of the United States, Prime Minister of England, or perhaps Prince Charles, Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada. What about other countries around the world, and are they expected to send their leaders as well?
Well, President of France is expected here as well, and a large number of foreign ministers. We're talking about 60 different countries. What's interesting is that unlike Rabin's funeral after he was assassinated in 95, when you had the president of Egypt came here, the king of Jordan arrived, there is no Arab or Muslim leader that we know of at this point who is coming. The Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, sent a condolence message to Peres' family, but we don't have any information on any Palestinian representative. And that kind of speaks to the difference between the state of the peace process today and when Rabin was assassinated, when there was a lot more hope then for progress and the Arab world was more open to Israel. Today, with the stalemate with the Palestinians, the likelihood of an Arab or Palestinian leader coming here is much less certain.
And the current Netanyahu regime would be partly responsible for that, one would assume.
Yes. Well, the mood that's being set between Israel and the Arab states, the Palestinians, has been set by, is very much a function of the attitudes of Netanyahu's government, also problems on the Palestinian side. But, of course, the tension between the two sides, the stalemate in the negotiations, the lack of negotiations, actually, it's a very different atmosphere than after the Rabin assassination. People here are saying that Peres' funeral will be the largest in terms of international participation since the Rabin funeral, but there's a world of difference where we are today and where we were then, and that's reflected in the participation on the Arab-Muslim side.
Once again, Joel Greenberg is a veteran freelance journalist based in Jerusalem. We are talking about Shimon Peres, one of the original founders, the last of the original founders of Israel, who died today at the age of 93, a statesman and a soldier both, and a peacemaker who never managed to make peace with the Palestinians. Joel, it's always great to have you on our program, and thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, Syria, where civilians are facing war without end. On To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on Alden back with To the Point. Secretary of State John Kerry hoped that the latest ceasefire deal with Russia might be extended toward ending almost 6 years of civil war in Syria, but the fighting hardly stopped, and now the siege of Aleppo is more intense than ever. We'll hear from a bombed-out neighborhood there. But first, here's Andrew Tabler. He's author of In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Assad's Syria. He's also a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Today, it's reported that Secretary of State Kerry has threatened in a phone call to the foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov, to break off negotiations with Russia over Syria. How important is that development?
It's extremely significant. The deal announced by Secretary Kerry not long ago had two components. One was delivering aid to Aleppo and relief to that city and to the opposition in general, and to improve access. And the other part of the agreement was targeting joint military strikes between the U.S. and Russia against extremist groups in Syria, which is very controversial. From the U.S. side, the first had to happen in order for the second to happen. So the deliveries had to happen first, and restoration of the ceasefire, and then the military cooperation would go into place. The Russians seemed to think that it was the opposite, that first we had agreed, sign on the dotted line, the military strikes were possible, and then aid would be let in as they and the Assad regime determined. And as a result of that confusion, the deal has effectively, despite being signed, fallen apart.
It's a pretty fundamental disagreement. Does it suggest that one side or the other didn't really want it to happen?
No, I think it just, unfortunately, the deal tried to paper over very significant differences over the future of Syria. The United States wants President Assad to step aside as part of a political negotiation, not immediately. The Russians do not want Assad to go. It's hard to, and they see him as the basis of a settlement in Syria. So there's that issue. The other controversial part is that the U.S. Does not trust Russia and vice versa. So, conducting joint military operations has been controversial, particularly on the American side, and has not yet occurred.
Andrew Taylor, once again at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. We'll come back to you in a moment. But first, Britain's Channel 4 has been airing very stark, very shocking footage shot by a resident of Aleppo. Barrel bombs have formed craters in that city, and broken pipes have created a waterhole for neighborhood boys to play in.
But the boys are loving it. And a pool party unlike any other has started. For a moment, they can pretend they're at a water park instead of a war zone. A few yards away, a woman's cries of grief. Her brother is dead beneath the rubble. Up above, her son looks down on where he used to live.
That was that young boy speaking to Waad Al-Khattab, who is the filmmaker who presented that footage. She is married to a doctor. They have an 8-month-old daughter living in Aleppo. Waad Al-Khattab, welcome to our program.
Hello.
Tell us, if you will, what did that boy, looking down at the pool with his mother weeping for her brother in the background, tell you?
Day after yesterday, I was going to document what's happening in Aleppo in bombing and the air forces attacked by the regime and the Russian air forces in Aleppo. And really was so surprised of this show when these children were swimming in a hole made by explosive barrel. I really was surprised, like you, like anyone see this report. Hope also always exists in Aleppo. We always, despite by all the death and damaged buildings and missing people, but hope always exists in Aleppo.
Did the boys, including the one you spoke with, seem to understand what was going on?
I think he was so understanding what's doing in Aleppo, because one of them, his house was just maybe 200 meters from the explosive barrel, and all children in Aleppo maybe missed their father or their mother and or their brothers, and a lot of families missing their house.
He indicated, as I understand it, that his family was buried under the rubble. Are there enough people, enough White Helmet aid workers to try to get those bodies out?
Yes, always a lot of stories do in the same attack. The White Helmets can survive a lot of people under rubbles, and unfortunately, always also there was a lot of people cannot go out under from the rubbles.
Tell us about your husband, the doctor, and what his work has been like.
My husband was a doctor. He graduated in 2011. So when Aleppo was liberated, we were in the eastern part of Aleppo. From 2012 until now, we are living in this part from Aleppo, and he's working in Al-Quds Hospital. He's one of the field hospital in the area. Now, from 72 days, he's the onlyest doctors in the ER room. He's 24/7 all time, and I'm and my daughter are living in the hospital with him.
Does he have children who are patients? We heard the children playing and swimming in the pools created by the bombs. But are children not also those among the injured?
All the attacks from by the regime or the Russian Air Forces targeted all buildings in Aleppo. There's also always there's children, there's babies, there's women and men. So we see that also. You can see in another reports or from other citizen journalists, you have a lot of children or babies. What are you expecting from a child that has been seeing the bombs for 5 years? When the planes targeted any place, the children in this place, they know that that might be die or injuries. And when they came to the hospital, they know a lot of things about their injuries or what will happening with them.
You live in East Aleppo, which is supposedly held by people opposed to President Assad. Do you blame President Assad for the bombing?
I don't know what's the right question. I'm not blame the President Assad. I'm really it's a very big word. It's not blame. Maybe my dream or our dream in Eastern Aleppo or also in Western Aleppo from a lot of people is to kill Al-Assad president or take him to the prisons in the United States or in the world. He's a criminal. He's he should be in Lahore, not just blame him.
Well, Ad al-Khattab, once again, a filmmaker, a resident of East Aleppo. We'll try to get back to her as our program goes forward. This Skype connection so far is working very well. I do want to introduce Vanessa Beely. She's an independent writer and photographer, recently returned from 4 weeks in Syria. During that time, she met with President Assad, along with various religious leaders and members of the Syrian opposition as well. Ms. Beely, good to have you on our program. We hear, of course, that it is the Assad regime that's responsible for what we have heard just described. It is also the Russians are being blamed for their involvement in it as well. What did you find when you met with President Assad? And do you also regard him as a criminal? I'm sorry, we're having some problem getting Vanessa Beely on the line. We will continue to make that effort. In the meantime, let me introduce Patrick Coburn. He's a journalist with the UK's independent newspaper, author of The Rise of Islamic State, ISIS, and the New Sunni Revolution. Patrick Coburn, good to have you on our program.
Hello.
At the least, we could hear in the voice of Wa'ad al-Khattab how extraordinarily difficult and complex this situation is in Syria. How does it look to you? You've been there, too.
It looks terrible, and it's getting worse. I think the ceasefire, which the U.S. and Russia agreed, was perhaps the most serious attempt to end the fighting, and looked how quickly that hit a rock and sank. So it's very difficult to see how this is going to be ended. It's not just one war. It's a series of wars. It's not all wrapped into one. It's not just in Syria. It's in Iraq. It's not just East Aleppo that has been shattered, but it's Ramadi in Iraq. 70-80% of the buildings destroyed. Most of the population fled. So this whole vast area between really the Iranian border over to the Mediterranean is being destroyed. And it's very difficult to see how this will be brought to an end.
Back to the ceasefire specifically and the situation in Aleppo, we hear in this country that it is the Assad regime that refused to stop a bombing along with the Russians, as we heard described earlier by Andrew Tabler. Does that appear to be the case? The Russians are blaming the United States.
Well, first of all, it's very difficult to establish facts in this sort of situation. I thought from the beginning I was in Damascus that actually, there wasn't a lot in this agreement for the opposition. The main fighting force in the non-ISIS, non-Islamic State opposition is what is al-Nusra. I know they've changed their name, but is al-Nusra. And why should they cooperate in an agreement which was going to end up by targeting them? So, you know, it was always pretty fragile. And it was also conducted in to be carried out, very delicate operations to be carried out in an atmosphere of total distrust. So when the U.S.-led air raids killed 62 Assyrian soldiers in Deir ez-Zor in east Syria, yes, the Syrian government thought it had been done deliberately. Then we have this aid convoy outside Aleppo with 31 trucks destroyed, which, again, for many people, will think that the Russians did deliberately. I don't know the answers to these. These, you know, every war I've covered, there's been these horrible accidents, and people always pretend that they have complete accuracy, and they don't. So it's very difficult to see any agreement coming out of this. And in the meantime, much of the population of Syria has been forced out of their houses. And it's not just East Aleppo, it's just in Damascus, in the Daraya area. You know, you go drive past whole of these sort of dark canyons of sort of empty streets, which have been battered by bombs and destroyed. The whole place is completely hell-like.
Patrick Coburn again, a journalist with UK's Independent newspaper, author of The Rise of the Islamic State, ISIS and the New Sunni Revolution. We'll be back. We'll continue our conversation. We do have now Vanessa Bealey on the line, who has just come back from 4 weeks in Syria, during which she met with President Assad. We'll hear what she was able to hear from him and talk to our other guests as well. On our talking point later on, Elon Musk and the highway to Mars. This is To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day and find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
We're only back with To the Point. Once again, talking about the civil war in Syria, a vastly destructive situation which has been going on for almost 6 years and has humanitarian consequences that are very difficult to cope with emotionally, even from this distance. Vanessa Bealey is with us, independent writer, photographer, recently returned from 4 weeks in Syria, during which time she did meet with President Assad, as well as others, including some of the Syrian opposition. Ms. Bealey, thank you very much for joining our program. Sorry we had difficulty getting you on the line.
You're welcome.
Tell us your impression of President Assad. He is very much demonized, I think, here in this country and blamed often for such atrocities as what we heard earlier, the bombing of East Aleppo, creating those craters where little boys are playing in the water while their families are buried by the rubble.
It's always interesting because I think the U.S. has a history from about the 1920s onwards of demonizing target nations, including Russia. In the 1920s, we started with the propaganda against the Russians, the Reds under the Beds, and we've gone through history with a demonization process, and in fact, since the Second World War, a sort of Hitlerization process. If we look at every nation that the United States has invaded, either by proxy or directly, we've seen a Hitlerization, as I call it, of...
Excuse me. We can't talk about all of those situations, but please tell us about the situation in Syria. And I'm asking you about it as President Assad.
I understand that. I'm just getting to that. You're asking my opinion of Assad, so I'm explaining the fact that there is a demonization process going on. We can't ignore there is a history of that. When I met President Assad, I met with a leader of a sovereign nation, an elected leader of a sovereign nation, who displayed an openness, an honesty, a desire to communicate, a desire to discuss very difficult subjects. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it's actually my opinion, the United States' opinion, the UK's opinion is irrelevant of Assad. What is relevant is the opinion of the Syrian people.
When you talked with President Assad, were you able to ask him about the attacks that Syrian forces are said to be making on their own people all over the country?
Absolutely. And as I spent 4 weeks in total traveling around all governorates of Syria, I formed my own opinions. I was in Aleppo for 2 days in August, and I would just like to correct a couple of things. Aleppo is not one homogeneous entity. It is East Aleppo and West Aleppo. And in West Aleppo, you have the majority of the Aleppans, the Syrian civilians, that have either taken refuge from Eastern Aleppo that they consider to have been invaded by NATO-backed terrorists into West Aleppo. 600,000 fled from East Aleppo into West Aleppo since 2012. And in West Aleppo are 1.5 million civilians. And in West Aleppo, there are 4,120 plus doctors. There are main hospitals. There are services and emergency centers that are never discussed. And today, for example, I was told by one of the doctors in Western Aleppo, which again has not been discussed in any media, that there was a rain, I quote, of mortars from the terrorist-held areas in Eastern Aleppo into West Aleppo, which killed a dozen people, injured dozens more, and paralyzed a six-year-old girl, Pamela Kazanji, her name was given to me just now, and added to that, there were Grad missile attacks into northern Aleppo countryside, into Al-Zara, which injured at least, again, dozens, but four children from one family, children from the age of 11 to the age of 1.5. Again, this is not mentioned.
Let me go back to Andrew Tabler, our senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, author of In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Assad's Syria. You have met yourself with President Assad, although not recently, as I understand it. What's your take on him and his role on what's going on now?
Well, you know, meeting up with President Assad, historically, the reason why they meet with people is so that they can carry their message out from Damascus to the outside world. And I think in this case, what we've just heard is, you know, is an example of that. It's unfortunate, I think, in the fact that, you know, there are a lot of people that are going to meet President Assad and actually come out with remarkably nuanced and critical evaluations. But what I just heard was a lot of paper overing of the events in Syria. I mean, talking about blaming the atrocities in places like Aleppo and so on the opposition, and while the opposition is getting barrel bombed, I mean, the opposition doesn't even have any aviation. It's very difficult to accomplish this. So I think that also that what's interesting is that as engagement with the Assad regime has gone up over time, actually his rhetorical position vis-a-vis negotiations with the opposition, as well as his behavior concerning on the battlefield, has actually worsened. Civilian areas have been hit more often. Russian support for that has also gone up. So it's not going in a good direction, and I don't think it will for the foreseeable future. And meanwhile, President Assad continues to say he's going to recapture every inch of Syrian territory.
I know you need to leave us, and I want to thank you very much for being on our program as long as you have. Andrew Tabler, once again, at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Vanessa Bealey, let me give you an opportunity to respond. What Mr. Tabler is saying is that President Assad meets with people such as yourself in order to carry a message out. That's what you've been doing. Are you, in fact, doing his work for him?
That's a wonderful suggestion, but no, I'm not. I'd also like to take up on Ms. Stabler's suggestion that there's no aviation. I think we saw a very clear example of the United States acting as the terrorist air force in Syria on the 16th of September. There is very clear evidence that the United States bombed for 1 hour the Syrian Arab army on the ground in Deir ez-Zor as they were fighting ISIS. We were then told that ISIS managed to take the territory. So the United States effectively acted as air cover. And for the time that the United States has, in theory, been waging a war against terror inside Syria, while they were doing it on their own before the Russians actually got involved in September 2015, we saw, for example, the ISIS convoys pass over 500 miles of desert without being bombed or targeted. We saw ISIS expand. We had reports from Iraq of U.S. airdrops to ISIS operatives and to actually Nusra operatives dropping food, supplies, and arms. We know that the Turkish borders have been used as arms running.
So you're saying the United States is covering up for ISIS, is helping ISIS? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying it's very suspicious that there are reports, for example, from Dr. Al-Jafari, the Syrian permanent representative at the UN, that the United States was communicating with Daesh or with ISIS on the ground prior to the attack.
Okay, let me go back to Patrick Coburn. Excuse me. Let me go back to Patrick Coburn again with the Independent from Britain. You've been in Syria. You talked earlier at some length about how extraordinarily complex this situation is. Do you think that the U.S. has, in fact, provided air cover for ISIS, allowed them to...
I'm sorry to be abrupt, but this is nonsense. It's conspiracy theories. You hear them all over Syria. I suspect the bombing was just a foul up, a major, which, you know, I've often seen done by bombers. I don't for a moment believe that the U.S. is involved in a conspiracy with Islamic State, and which it has been bombing consistently. We're going to have many criticisms of U.S. policy in Iraq and Syria, but I think that this shouldn't be one of them. I think that, you know, what I think people miss it in Syria is it's a genuine civil war with people strongly committed on each side, each pretending that the other has no support whatsoever. But if you move on a little and say, how can this be ended? I don't think there's a solution, but there are so many, as I said earlier, conflicts wrapped into one. But one needs to have a ceasefire somehow. One needs to demilitarize the situation. Then you can maybe proceed just towards some long-term solutions. But at the moment, we have what we used to call in Northern Ireland the politics of the last atrocity. And the last atrocity determines what anybody does. So the failure of the recent ceasefire shows how many different things have to click into place simultaneously to bring an end to the fighting. And we're still a long way from that.
Let me go back to our filmmaker and resident of East Aleppo, once again, whose husband is a doctor, who described earlier how very difficult it is for him to do the work that he does with the bombing that is going on, Wa'ad al-Khattab. What do you say to the idea that the city of Aleppo is, in fact, divided, that there are people on the western side who are attacking the east, and just as the east is being, there are people on the, I beg your pardon, people on the eastern side that are attacking the west, where Assad supporters are, and that people have fled from the east to the west because they do support Assad, and they are not in favor of al-Nusra and some of the other opponents. Is the city so divided, and if so, where do you come down?
Really, I'm from the western part of Aleppo, and I'm fled to the eastern side in 2012 because I was wanted from the regime. I was a university student in Aleppo University. I was studying marketing, and I couldn't graduate because I was wanted. As me, there's a lot of people, there's a lot of students, there's a lot of engineering, and a lot of doctors. All of them aren't tourists. My daughter, it's 8 months old, isn't tourist. 350,000 people isn't all tourists. I was wondering about Vanessa, if she visits the prisons in the western side, if she hear the sounds of air forces that attack us in Aleppo. I cannot imagine what are people sit with the president al-Assad and don't go to Daraya to see what's happening in this city. Where's their people? Did you see Venetia, the Iran's militia in the western Aleppo? Did you see the Russians? Did you see the Afghanistan's militia? Are they every one in the western Aleppo are civilians? I don't think so.
All right. So again, then, this is a very complicated situation, as we are hearing, and people on both sides are struggling, I would guess, to understand the others. Patrick Coburn, back. Let me go back to you. Was Secretary of State Kerry naive in thinking that it would be possible to put together a ceasefire under these circumstances?
I don't think naive. I think Kerry comes out of this pretty well. as he kept saying, you know, it's difficult to think of any alternative except more war, more deaths, things getting worse and worse, and he was trying to avert that. It hasn't happened. You know, maybe it was never going to happen. But, you know, when it was actually agreed, there seemed to be reasons why Russia would try to push Assad into following this agreement to ceasefire. There was a lot for the Russians in it of military cooperation with the U.S. against terrorism, which they've always wanted. But I think the one thing that has come out of the last few weeks is that the Russian ability to influence Assad may be less than we imagined and less than Secretary Kerry imagined. And the ability of the U.S. to influence regional powers that back the armed opposition may have been less than we thought.
We heard earlier...
Sorry,
I was just going to say, we heard earlier that Assad was, of course, elected. There's been some concern about whether the election was fair or not, but he was elected.
Yeah, I think we could say a little bit more than concern. I mean, these are sort of nominal elections. I'm not somebody who believes that all the ills of Syria can be dumped on Assad, and if we got rid of him, everything would be great. I think that's naive and simple-minded. But at the same time, to see Assad as a protagonist of democracy, I think is wholly unrealistic, to say the least.
What about a division of Syria? Do you think that that is in the cards, or that any of the external players, the U.S. or Russia, for example, want to see a division of Syria?
They don't, but Syria is already divided, you know. It's divided more than most countries in the world. You have frontiers, so to speak, or battle lines all over the country that are divided up, even within cities, within Damascus itself, and other places. So it's already divided. Does it sort of turn into several different countries and it... cartographers have to produce different maps? Maybe not, but already you have a very deep level of division. And this isn't just at the top, it goes right down. There's deep suspicion, you know, between Kurds and Arabs, between Shia and Sunni, Alawite Christians, and Sunni, between secular Sunni and religious Sunni, because there's so much blood and lack of any trust. And that will take a long time to come back. So there may be somewhere called Syria on the map, but it's going to be a divided, fragmented country.
We're going to have to leave it at that, but I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Patrick Coburn with the Independent newspaper in Britain, Vanessa Bealey, who met recently with President Assad, Andrew Tabler at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and very particularly Wa'ad al-Khattab, our filmmaker, our resident of East Aleppo, who is trying to survive in a situation where the barrel bombs are, as we heard, creating craters where they're now filling with water and children are playing as their families are buried and killed by the bombing. Ms. al-Khattab or Mrs. al-Khattab, thank you very much, and all the best to your doctor, husband, and the extraordinary effort that he has had to put forth now as the only doctor left in the ER in that neighborhood. Thank you all very much for being on our program today. Elon Musk may or may not ever go to Mars, but he wants to help our species to get there. We'll have more on that in a moment on To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
Oh, and only we're here with today's talking point. Elon Musk is a well-known entrepreneur whose projects include electric cars and reusable space rockets. Yesterday at the International Astronautical Conference in Guadalajara, he told an audience that the human species has only two alternatives. The first is inevitable extinction by one means or another here on Earth. There is another way.
The alternative is to become a spacefaring civilization and a multi-planet species, which I hope you would agree that is the right way to go. Yes?
Ian O'Neill is an astrophysicist and senior producer for Space at Discovery News. Good to have you back on our program.
Hi there, Warren. Thanks for having me on the show.
Would you have been applauding there as Elon Musk set up those rather grim-sounding alternatives?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's certainly a fun announcement, very exciting. And, you know, if anybody could make it happen on this planet, it's probably going to be Elon Musk and SpaceX right now. So, yeah, exciting times.
He's talking about a manned mission to Mars in 6 years?
Well, yes. I mean, even in his own mission, the timeline is a bit fuzzy. So he is actually hoping to launch an unmanned capsule to the red planet around about 2018. So they're going to be testing technologies pretty early. But yeah, I mean, the timeline is pretty tight. Within the next decade for a manned mission to Mars, a SpaceX manned mission to Mars. So this would be well ahead of NASA's plan to send an astronaut to Mars. And, you know, his technology is really maturing and, you know, he has got a viable space business. So he's going to give it a go. So why not?
So he can get people there. But to what extent is he thinking about what they do once they arrive?
Well, this is the thing. So Elon Musk is in the business of space transportation. So he's going to set up this in-space infrastructure, and he's called it the Interplanetary Transport System. And by his specifications, he's saying this is a system. He's not just building a rocket. He's not just building a spaceship. He's building an infrastructure. So it's almost like the first freeways in the United States. He's building that infrastructure into space so we can make it affordable and renewable. So we're not just sending rockets up and throwing them away. We're actually bringing them back, because that's his big technology he's got at the moment, is, you know, bringing back these booster rockets back to Earth so they can be reused. So that basically saves on costs. Rather than just a single-use rocket, he can actually reuse them. And this is going to be carried forward into this space infrastructure, this ITS. And he's hoping that by doing this, by making access to space cheap, and he's driving down prices a lot. I mean, compared to the Apollo program, he's going to be driving down launch costs by like 5,000,000%. I mean, it's a ridiculous number. So he's got really, really lofty goals. But if he can do that, perhaps he can infuse private industries, governments, countries, even the whole planet, perhaps a UN consortium of people that actually want to fund perhaps a permanent presence on the Martian surface. And he's talking about a sustainable presence on Mars, so basically using in-situ resources and having up to 1 million people in the first instance within the first 100 years of shuttling people out there.
100 years of shuttling people out there, so we're talking about a long time.
Yes, this is a big, big idea. I mean, this isn't just Elon Musk's, you know, launching satellites into space for profit. He's looking to help mankind become multiplanetary. And if he can do that through building this infrastructure in space, perhaps we actually have a chance of living on other planets and having a sustainable presence. Because at the moment, NASA's hoping to get boots on Mars within the next 20 years or something. That time frame keeps on getting pushed back because it's a very, very hard thing to do, especially on government budgets and especially NASA budgets, where everything is very, very expensive to do. Elon Musk wants to bring down these prices, and hopefully we can actually have the resources then to actually get people on Mars in a sustainable way rather than just a one-off deal.
So we can get there. We can build the infrastructure, perhaps space stations along the way. But what about once we arrive, and how far along are we in the technology that would allow people to survive in a situation where there is no atmosphere such as we know it, and you'd have to create something in order to sustain human life? That wouldn't be easy.
Exactly. I mean, life support systems are, you know, they're being tested on the International Space Station. So we actually have an orbital laboratory that's doing this right now. We've had a permanent manned presence now for well over a decade on the International Space Station, which is an amazing feat. So if we can use what we've learned from those lessons of living in space and space stations that have come before it, because, of course, the Russian space station, the Mir space station, and also Skylab, we're good at doing this. But we've never tried it on another planetary surface. I mean, we've only ever gone to the moon, and that was, you know, just for a couple of days and then come back. To actually have a sustainable presence where you're actually using resources that are there to produce oxygen, produce water, produce fuel, that's a key thing as well with Elon Musk's return trips. These spaceships are actually going to return from Mars to come back to Earth to be reused to send more people out there. If we can do that, if we can make it sustainable, some of the technology is there, but it needs to mature. So that's why this whole time frame thing about sending, you know, a permanent human presence to Mars in the next 10 years is, you know, very, very, would be very tough to achieve, especially as we don't have the technology yet. But we are getting there. I mean, this isn't science fiction anymore. We can actually do this.
So by this, you mean we can get there. Again, let's put aside for a moment the question of what we do once we arrive or how we sustain ourselves. Where's he getting the money now, and is he getting help of the sort that you say he has been trying to generate from governments, from other private companies, or whatever sources he can find?
Yeah, and, you know, this is another one of the challenges. So first, obviously, is time a big challenge, and funding is another big challenge. Technology is a lesser a challenge if you have those two components in place. So funding at the moment, SpaceX is funded by NASA grants, NASA partnerships. So basically, it's paid by NASA to launch equipment and supplies to the International Space Station. And that's a very lucrative deal, and other private space companies are doing the same thing. So this is a very interesting era where you've got partnerships between private enterprises launching private rockets to government-owned space stations. So that's great. That's a good first step. Also, SpaceX is launching private satellites into space. So there's another revenue stream there. And Elon Musk envisages some sort of, you know, private-public partnership in the future that would, you know, could also sustain this space infrastructure. But it's all very foggy at the moment because we just don't know where the money's going to come from. He has an idea how much it's going to cost, but he certainly doesn't have the money yet. But he's hoping to do more of the same, more of the launches, bigger rockets, bigger payloads into space, more customers. And so hopefully they can fund a lot of themselves, but they will need government funding. So they'll be doing more partnerships with NASA, no doubt, and also perhaps, you know, larger international partnerships. Who knows? But that is another gray area. We just don't know if the money is going to be there yet. But he says he's got the technology to do it, so he's hoping it's going to snowball once we see this dream could be a reality.
Will tourism to the International Space Station or other such places, or just rides around in orbit, be part of the funding for those wealthy enough to want to do that?
No doubt. I mean, that's always going to be a component. There's other spaceflight companies, I mean, like Virgin Galactic, in test flights in the Mojave Desert. That could be a component. But once you drive down launch costs, anything is really possible. I mean, you can basically get anywhere in the solar system.
Ian O'Neill at Discovery News, always good to have you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
All next week on To the Point, we'll be airing a series on the policy debates we're not hearing from Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. We'll look at what's really at stake, from public education to climate change to world peace. That's next week, Monday through Friday, on our program. I'm Warren Olney. To the Point is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.